Hi, this is Zena Harris.
And I'm Mark Rabin.
Welcome to the tie-in.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome back to The Tie-In. Today, we're speaking with James Elsmore, a social entrepreneur with a key focus on renewable energy and sustainable development for remote, rural, and island communities. He's the CEO of Island Innovation, the co-founder of Solar Head of State, and a regular contributor to publications from around the globe. James also heads up the Global Sustainable Island Summit, a series of in-person events dedicated to advancing sustainable development on islands worldwide, in partnership with the government of St. Kitts and Nevis. And this conference just happened at the end of May, so we look forward to hearing a little bit more about that.
Yeah. Hi, James. Welcome to the tie-in.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're really excited to talk to you. You know, just to set the scene, and give us a bit of context, I'm just curious, you know, how did you get into social entrepreneurship and specifically focused on renewable energy and sustainable development in island communities?
Yes, so my original, I guess, area of interest or expertise was on renewable energy and looking at the energy transition. And the reason that I got specifically interested in island communities is that around the globe, islands tend to have these very, very high cost of electricity. So the cost of generation or the cost the consumer pays may be 3 or 4 times more than on the mainland. And so when there is a mainland. And so what that means is it has an effect on the whole economy. If your electricity is expensive, how can you manufacture anything that's competitive? How do you grow crops or any other kind of foodstuffs? It has this knock-on effect down the whole economy. So that was kind of the original interest for me. And I was very fortunate enough to work for several years in the Caribbean, do a research project in the South Pacific, and also have experience in the Scottish Islands, where I did my master's degree in island studies, which, you know, it's people are always surprised to hear that's a real master's degree. But anyway, very different regions, but seeing actually these commonalities that connected them when it comes to sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
Just to double click on that, the why of the cost of energy in these islands. I mean, they're still burning diesel. Is that the main driver of cost? Why is it so expensive on islands?
Part of it is just scale. Whenever you do anything at a small scale, you have higher fixed costs. And so that drives up your cost for everything. So in general, living on an island is more expensive in multiple areas. Mm-hmm. Import things, etc. But many islands, as you say, do depend on imported fossil fuels to obviously drive cars, to run their diesel generators. But also many islands are really leading in the transition. So the idea of island innovation is when you're put in this really special circumstance with these drivers, it also forces you to innovate. So if your cost of electricity is really high, you're going to be more proactive in looking for new solutions. So at the same time, many islands have been stuck with these outdated fossil fuel generation systems, but many islands have also been at the forefront when it comes to adopting renewable energy, especially solar and electric vehicles, and looking at that transition because these unique circumstances, these constraints push innovation.
Mm-hmm. Can we dive in a bit on the energy transition and the systems involved on islands and kind of can you help us understand what those innovations are, what they look like for island nations?
Totally. And we talk about island nations, island territories, so a whole range of different places. And part of our goal is that you have a state like Hawaii, a territory like Greenland, or an independent country like Fiji. All of those have, again, similar geographies in certain ways, and this commonality of remoteness or isolation. And so we look at these commonalities across all of them, despite also the many differences that they have. And so when it comes to electricity, you may have a very small grid, which is isolated, very different than a continental system. When you're able to buy from a neighboring country or a neighboring state, you're reliant on what you can produce locally. And so, as I said, the tradition has been to use diesel generators, but obviously solar in many island communities, also wind in the further north areas, provides an opportunity to transition away from that. And so there are challenges when it comes to that transition. A state like Hawaii is a good example where they were really led on that solar energy transition. But they reached a point, I think it was around 40% of renewable energy use, where the problem was not adopting more renewables, but it was how the grid adapts to that. Renewables also bring some challenges with them. And so many islands kind of get to a certain point where you can increase, but it's not so easy just to install a lot of solar and go straight to 100. You have to adapt the grid, you have to think of storage, you have to think of all these other elements that need to be incorporated. And that's the challenge that many islands are facing. But the biggest cost is normally finance. You know, it might be that it makes a lot of sense financially to move towards solar energy, but you've got to have the next 10 years worth of energy bills ready to make that upfront investment, even if there's a long-term saving opportunity. So a lot of where we come in is looking at how to actually finance that type of transition, and which again is a big challenge for many islands, especially in the global south.
Yeah, you're basically trading in your dirty OpEx for clean CapEx, but you've got to invest in all of your power and energy upfront.
And then you've got other challenges. So maybe it's that your insurance in somewhere like the Caribbean, where you're prone to hurricane, it might make a lot of sense, but your insurance could be a limiting factor. So to have an investable project, you also need to cover all these elements. Or that in many developing countries or the global south, the cost of money is much higher than it is in developed countries. So the interest on your loan might be three, four, five times higher than it would be in the US or in Europe.
And one more question on that, down that path, just to lay the land. It's so the first thing that comes to my mind is, okay, great. So we're gonna install all these solar farms and complex systems, and then a hurricane's gonna come through and then, you know, basically tear it all up. You know, how are you and the island nations preparing to harden that infrastructure? And are we there? Are we at that point where we can install solar farms that are hurricane resistant?
I mean, you have to think that in at some level, nothing can be fully hurricane resistant, right? So if an extremely strong hurricane comes through, you're in the eye of the storm, doesn't matter any infrastructure that's built. But no one is saying we should not build any infrastructure in Florida. Hurricane might come, right? So it's kind of the same principle. There is that risk. You have to incorporate that risk through insurance, and there's a lot of work being done on both improving the infrastructure to be more resistant, but also to ensure that the finance is there in the event of a disaster. There's always a percentage chance in any region of a disaster happening. So there's a preparation element, which is critical for that. But that being said, renewables can actually really add to the resiliency and the response when a hurricane comes through. So by what's called distributing your electricity, having your electricity generated in multiple places, you could argue that an island would actually be much safer. And so Puerto Rico is a really good example. When Hurricane Maria came in and the island, some parts of the island didn't have power for a year, a lot of people looked to distributed electricity as a way to get past that. What happened in Puerto Rico was all of that, or the majority of the energy generation, was very centralized in one part of the island. And that was the part that got hit. So it meant that the whole capacity was wiped out overnight, whereas actually not the whole island was destroyed. So if that energy had been distributed across the island, it would have made it much more resilient in the effect that one part of the island was hit. But before we lose people, I want to say, I don't know if we're not just having a deep renewable energy conversation. And part of what I want to do, and in this conversation, the work that we do is show how that's applicable to the wider economy. So a lot of these islands are very tourism dependent. How does renewable energy link to that? some of the highest levels of food, of imported foods are also in the island. So you might think, oh, you have a tropical island that's very fertile, you can grow a lot. But then they're importing the majority of the food that's consumed. So all of these things are actually linked together. And the interesting thing when you're looking at an island system, it's much easier to make those links and see how food, tourism, waste, blue economy or ocean issues and conservation are all linked together.
I feel like I'm on a location scout right now. I'm learning about, what the risks are, what the opportunities, what the systems are in a given location so that I can assess, how we're going to bring this project, this, film or TV show to a given location. So, at least I assume that's what everybody's going through when they have these conversations. But yeah, I mean, thinking through like what the climate risks are, what the costs are associated with those risks. I assume on the insurance side, that's a key consideration. Just on that in particular, before we get into kind of these other links that you mentioned, are you noticing any shifts, any conversations in that space about opportunities to reduce risk in climate nations? Or territories and insurance. I'm just curious how that link comes together.
Yeah, I mean, and the challenge that we have is quantifying that risk is difficult because it's speculative to a point. You can look over time and look at trends, but the idea is that climate change is accelerating those changes. And so looking at a 25-year span for a project lifespan, say, the risk over that 25 years is somewhat speculative. And so people want to be risk averse. And you're even seeing that now, not an island, but post wildfires, the cost of getting insurance on the West Coast is prohibitive for many people. So you're seeing more and more people in California not insuring their homes anymore because insurance companies either won't do it or just quote so much that it's not worth it. So you're seeing these similar challenges. And I think that's there are some islands that so Bermuda is a island that's also has a big insurance industry. And so they've really been pioneering how do we better quantify this? Because if you can give data, then actually insurance companies are perhaps thinking of the worst possible case scenario that may not actually be there. So finding this middle ground, it's still a new area. And it's something that the finance institutions really need to get on board with and accept that we're going through this change in climate. So there are going to be different risks that that come out of that, but also opportunities that come out of that. And again, for me, the renewables aspect, it's not just people think, oh, we're reducing carbon emissions. That's obviously part of it, but for many of the islands, it's actually about being better equipped to cope with climate change. Renewables, so you have the adaptation side and the mitigation side, and renewables play into both of those.
Yeah. I mean, the islands are ground zero for climate change, right? I mean, really, at the end of the day, but also have that, as you mentioned, that opportunity to really, really take a leadership role and, yeah.
Yeah, and not just climate change. So again, the fragility comes on the economic side as well. So going back to if there is a global spike in oil prices, and in some parts of the Pacific or the Caribbean, one third of your GDP is spent on importing oil-based or fossil fuel products, that can have a huge impact on your economy. Importing foods and the cost of logistics go up, that has a big effect. And the big one was COVID. There was some the worst impacted part of the world for COVID as a percentage was the Caribbean because it's the most tourist dependent part of the world. So some islands like Aruba, up to 90% of their economy is tourism focused. And you also don't have I guess a hinterland, the mainland that can help subsidize the people that have lost their jobs. So you had real risk of people losing their livelihoods and just needing to put food and drink on the table. It's a real juxtaposition when you have islands that are fundamentally dependent on air travel for their industry, but at the same time are completely dependent on the tourism industry to bring in basic jobs for the majority of the population in some cases.
So just kind of thinking through that the tourism piece and how some islands are dependent, as you said. I'm just curious, how does that affect, local policies and systems on waste and other aspects of the economy locally, that we may, that we can think through here? Like how I'm curious on that.
One of the big challenges that the average tourist per day uses more energy, more water, and less and creates more waste than the local person. So if you have which you kind of expect, right? You think about people are on holiday,
You're,
they're
yeah.
not thinking about these things, they're enjoying themselves. Of course they do. But obviously that mounts up on a national level that can have a huge implication. And there is a real backlash that we've seen against tourists in many parts of the world. So Maui post wildfires had a big backlash, and there is still a "Don't Visit Hawaii" movement in some parts. The Canary Islands as well is another example. You may have seen that in Spain there has been this very push backlash against tourism, and a lot of that is against mass tourism. You don't necessarily see that in the Seychelles that have a very high-end, low-volume tourism. Not saying there's not problems with it, but there is not necessarily a public backlash. In the Canary Islands, the island of Gran Canaria receives more tourists per year than the whole of Brazil internationally. Population of less than 1 million and 7 or 8 million tourists per year coming to visit the island. That's because you can get there from the UK or Germany for under 100 euros round trip on a flight. So it's a low-cost destination. A
Right.
lot of people depend on that industry, but at the same time, with the rise of Airbnb, with all these other challenges, it creates a certain discontent. And it puts a real difficult case for the government that knows its economy is reliant on tourism, but also its voters are getting frustrated with the tourists. Trying to navigate that is really tricky. And I don't think that, no tourism is the option, but equally, how do you find a middle ground there? And it's not something that there are some examples of places that have solved that, but it's a big challenge for many destinations.
Oh,
And
go
how
ahead.
would that parlay into, well, I was just gonna say, I don't know, Zeno, what you're gonna say, but to into the filming. I mean, have you touched into some of the, because obviously that's a huge business. I mean, even here in Vancouver, for example, there's some filming locations that literally every day there's a new filming crew that takes over the whole entire street, blocks, shuts it down. Some people are not into that, right? But how does that been reflected on in the islands? I'm sure there's lots of film crews coming there and folks doing all types of media work there.
It's interesting. It's not an area that is my area of expertise in terms of the filming. One area which is a bit broader is called MICE is the acronym, MICE, Meetings, Incentives, Conventions and Events. That has been a big area which I would say is a parallel to the filming. I don't know of any islands that have really specialized in filming as a big industry, and maybe you could tell me. Part of that might be of the cost of operating in an island is much higher. So sometimes your tropical beach setting is actually filmed in a mainland area and not on the island, because for a film crew going to an island, they're going to have much higher costs to be able to do that, and other challenges of importing things, getting all their equipment there, everything else. But the MICE tourism, as it's called, meetings and conventions, is an area that many islands are really investing in. Hawaii has a big convention bureau. The Canary Islands have a big convention bureau. Dominican Republic as well. And the governments see that it helps to, it's still tourism, but it helps to diversify the tourism a little bit away from the sun, sand, and sea element, and potentially get people to see the islands as a place to do business, as opposed just as a place to go for the beach. That's something that governments may see. Okay, if we invest 1 million euros, $1 million, bringing this event to the island, the government pays those upfront costs, but actually 5 million is spent as a spin-off in local businesses, in hotels, everything else. So there's quite a few places that are actually competing with each other to bid to bring different conferences, events for different sectors to their destinations for that, and especially off season. The challenge for many islands is your tourism season might be crammed into 3, 6 months of the year. So what happens for the rest of the year? So bringing off-season tourism is also a big challenge.
I'm curious, when islands are thinking about things like material management and waste and these sorts of things, and they've got their systems set up for their towns, their cities, and then I'm curious if you know of examples, or if you've heard of this, where like for us, we think a lot about film and TV, and so film crew may come in. Do islands treat guests like that, if you will, kind of the same as other residents on their island in terms of like how they interact with local policies, how they may interact with for example, the waste system or whatever, to kind of hold to a standard, if you will, of that island. I'm curious because there're kind of famous stories of like film crews going to an island and kind of trashing the place, if you will, and then leaving. And then because it was such a famous show, a famous movie, then you've got the, knock-on effect of film tourism, and they then come and they want to, look at that, what was a pristine beach in that film, and that sort of thing. So I'm just curious, kind of like, if you have any thoughts on that process and kind of those knock-on effects.
Yeah, I think the legislative part is really important. What rules are in place? I mean, it's one thing having the policies in place, it's another thing enforcing them as well. But it's also this inherent contrast that your tourism is normally dependent on natural beauty. And so you've got to, again, find a way to ensure that the beaches are clean, there's not waste everywhere, because otherwise you'll lose your tourism, right? So that's where you get to the idea of carrying capacity, that any one destination only has a certain level of carrying capacity. I believe that there is a really important role for government entities to enforce that, because ultimately the tourism industry is a for-profit industry that's wanting to maximize its profits. And there will be some things that happen for its own marketing reasons, let's say. The tourism industry also wants to be seen as green to a point. But again, that tends to be in the higher end tourism, that there is this kind of ability to reduce to change. And because there is a premium being charged, they also have a bit of extra room. If there is not a big premium being made per tourist, there's also less incentive for anything that might cost the industry more. So I do think there is an important role for regulation there. The cruise industry is probably one of the worst in terms of being unregulated, and they have a lot of power over their de destinations. So when destinations try to create even small rules for the cruise industry, or increase visitor fees, so a per visitor fee for anyone coming, the industry just often threatens to pull away completely. And so when you have a lot of, I think the Caribbean is a good example, because you're very close to Florida, you have a lot of destinations alongside each other. If any one of those islands decides to legislate against air pollution coming from a cruise ship, the cruise industry will just say, fine, we won't come. And that's a big chunk of money that they're losing. There's been some, especially the big corporate tourism sector, there've been some quite shady practices there in coercion. So the government does have a role, but it's a difficult one to sometimes bring the corporations along with them.
Are there any I guess international coalitions around this, or any networks that help in these ways?
There's a lot of work being done on the tourism industry to move the tourism along. And some of that comes from visitor pressure. Some of that comes from the individual governments. And then there are also different groups that work on this. But it is somewhat piecemeal, because tourism is regulated in a different way in different areas. But there are groups that represent regions. So there's the Caribbean Tourism Organization, there's the Pacific Tourism Organization. They each have sustainability movements, but they're also member driven somewhat. So they depend on the need. So I think there is a need here for guests themselves to push for that as well, because the tourism industry ultimately is going to respond best to demand.
Right.
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 And so what innovations then, just to sort of pull it back to this, what island innovations are we seeing? Are you starting to see unique things start to spawn out of these demands for more sustainable tourism? Yeah, what are you seeing on the ground? Because that's where my head goes to, and just as I'm looking
Honestly,
at
not.
what your work that you're working on.
Yeah, not as much in the tourism sector as it could be. It's, even things like moving to plastic straws, because moving away from plastic straws rather, become a huge fight. So you think if plastic, if just that one act becomes a difficult one, how do you tackle the big issues? But there are different things happening on different islands, especially in the energy sector. A lot of places that are moving that. There's an uptake from island-based businesses to use renewables. A lot of that is driven by cost. Ultimately, if the profit margin shows that renewables are cheaper, you get more adoption, right? And if the money is available and there aren't other financial barriers. So a lot of it is cost-driven. Waste is a really big challenge that is not just related to the tourism industry, but waste processing. There are the small islands in Japan, they often incinerate it. There's a big incineration which can also contribute to energy generation. But that also comes with a lot of backlash. People don't like the idea of incinerating. But sometimes you'll see the most beautiful tropical islands. I'm not going to name any names here, I'll get in trouble, but that have these huge trash piles in the middle of the island because there is not solid waste management. And solid waste management can be it solid waste management is really difficult to do on a small scale. Recycling only works if you have large volumes, otherwise it's not economically viable. So it's a lot of pieces of the puzzle that needs to come together, a lot of challenges, but there is also some big opportunities to leverage this and move forward. So people are already thinking outside the box to try and say, how do we do plastic recycling on a small scale? How do we incentivize people to make sure that waste is being collected and processed? I think the one thing we haven't perhaps touched on as much is food and the food security challenge. If you look at some of the countries with the highest rates of obesity in the world, they tend to be island nations. And part of that is because you're so dependent on imported food, and that means processed food. And so there is this link also between health and the food system. And sometimes, even when that food could be grown locally, because of the energy cost, because of labor cost, it's cheaper to import it. So you end up importing food that could be grown locally, but it's the cost again gets in the way. So it all comes back to, I guess, everything comes back to money.
Row and energy.
In energy,
Energy.
I mean, I've heard, in I mean, I guess across the board, you hear stories about like large companies coming in and kind of dominating a local market and squeezing out, local mom and pop shops, these kinds of things that then probably control then more, like you said, like the food system, because they, this is where everybody now needs to shop and they will sell what they sell. Is that kind of the main driver of this? Because it just seems like there could be, or maybe there are incentives for local farming or local, I guess local farming, local food manufacturing, whatever that looks like.
And some of it comes back to scale. The fact that you can only do farming on a small scale means that it's more expensive per unit of whatever you're producing. But again, this is some, I think this is an area where there is some in innovation around different styles of farming. So actually, I have a colleague in Aruba, which is a very, very dry island with very little rainfall, which also has very large hotels. And they now produce around 10% of all the lettuce consumed in Aruba. And before that, it was, I mean, still 90% is imported. The vast majority is imported. There's a few other very smaller producers as well. But more or less, you get an idea. They're importing massive amounts of lettuce, and tourists will want their salads and want all their lettuce as they would expect in the United States or in Europe. And so being able to grow that locally has been a real game changer, and they're using a hydroponic system. So that's a company called Happy Ponics in Aruba, and they've really been expanding. But often the big hotels in other islands are not willing to buy from local suppliers because they want consistency. So they've been able to, with the hydroponic system, offer a year-round consistency and know every month they're producing so much. But if you're growing traditional agriculture, you have a growing season, you have storms coming in, you don't necessarily, you're not able to provide on a weekly basis a consistent supply to the big hotel chains, which are the ones that are the biggest demand on the island. And so the hotel chains just say, well, we'll import it then, because we know we can have a fixed supply throughout the year that is more dependable.
It's amazing how this is all connected, right? Like you can
That's
start
exactly
just
what I was just thinking. I mean,
I
it's just everything is connected, but there's also it does seem like there's a tremendous amount of opportunity, right? And to also to bring the whole, I don't know if you, the CARICOM region and all the islands, but especially we're talking a lot about the Caribbean here too, to work together and to create broader value chains around the islands, and and just sort of really bring everybody together at the table, right? It seems like there's that's the opportunity that you're working on, and that's probably what you're doing with the Global Sustainable Islands Summit. Can you speak to us a little bit about that and what the main outcomes were?
Absolutely. So, yes, Caribbean on my mind, just got back from St. Kitts and Nevis, where we hosted the third Global Sustainable Island Summit. That's our kind of flagship event, as you mentioned, that goes to a different region every year. So the first one was in Madeira in Portugal. Last year, we were in Prince Edward Island, a province of Canada, Canada's smallest
I know
province.
it. I know
So,
it well.
yeah, three very different islands.
Very different.
It was really interesting last year in Prince Edward Island, having this big Caribbean delegation come up there and actually see how many parallels there were around the energy transition. Obviously, Prince Edward Island has a very agricultural base, so they are producing a lot of their own food. But there are still some dependencies on tourism being a major sector. There's a big seasonality in Prince Edward Island. And then next year we'll be going to Gran Canaria in the Canary Islands. So again, looking at a very different location, but that has a big water challenge, that's doing a lot of innovation. They have an amazing program innovating renewable energy there. So some really cutting edge research on ocean energy and how to leverage the waves and the ocean to generate electricity. A lot of renewables already deployed in Gran Canaria. The goal of that event is to break down some of these barriers. So how do we get people in the same room from government, from the private sector, from the NGOs, and from the universities, academia? Because those four sectors often are may want the same thing or are working, but they don't always talk to each other. Often there'll be events focused on the government side or on the private sector side. Trying to get those people in the same room is challenging, but actually there's a lot of reward for that. And then also across different areas of sustainable development. So we talked about the food, the tourism, the energy, the waste, all these different areas, conservation being a big one, because as we've discussed already, I think we've shown that those things are very interlinked. And so it's a systems approach to thinking about sustainable development, as opposed to just trying to solve one problem in one area. But what was really rewarding in St. Kitts and Nevis, we had delegates come from Fiji, from Vancouver Island, from Japan, from Mauritius, and across the Caribbean, of course, and seeing where, we've solved this one part on our island. So by definition, islands are remote. So our approach is to try and make those links and say, okay, this has worked really well in one place, the hydroponic solution I mentioned in Aruba. How could that model be expanded to other islands? And then in return, what can Aruba take back, maybe when it comes to energy or another sector?
Seems super important given, like we need to be doing these kinds of things faster and bringing people together and kind of cross-pollinating and whatnot, seems super important now. So well done in that on that. So we ask everyone this, and I'm really curious to hear your take on it. So if you're going to create a playbook about the work that you do, what would be the first guiding principle on your list?
Playbook, you mean like in terms of how we operate, our operating? Okay, I think it would be that everyone has something to offer. We are a platform that brings people together. Our team really represents many different islands. So we're a remote group of people. Many of our team are working from different islands around the world. But really, it's a platform where everyone gets to share their experiences and share their knowledge, whether they're from, a high-level professor in a university, or they're a really small community group solving something in their specific location.
That's
Love
awesome.
it. Yeah, that's
That's
great.
awesome. Well, how can people find out more about what you do, what Island Innovation is?
Absolutely. So islandinnovation.co is our website, but if you just Google us, you will be up there near the top our pages. You can see information on our different events. In September, we have our annual virtual event, the Virtual Island Summit, which is actually where we started before COVID with this new innovative virtual event idea. But it's obviously for our community, it makes a lot of sense because we can have maximum participation and maximum representation from as many different islands as possible. We had one speaker from an island, Tristan da Cunha, which hasn't got an airport in the South Atlantic, presenting about how they manage waste. For them to attend a conference, there's, I think, one boat every 3 months that takes
Whoa.
4 days to get to Cape Town. So, a particularly extreme example, but they do have a decent internet connection. And so they could present how they're approaching waste management. That's an extreme example, but you get the idea. So, a virtual island summit in September is free to attend. And we encourage anyone to sign up just for their interests. And then also the in-person event that will be next year in May in Gran Canaria, that's also going to be a really exciting opportunity. So do check out the website, and we're on Instagram, LinkedIn, wherever else you might find us to learn more about that and share kind of weekly. We have this newsletter that really just shares stories, inspiring stories from different islands around the world.
Awesome.
Love
Awesome.
it.
Well, looking forward to entertainment incorporating some of that. And especially we're always looking to learn how other people are, handling waste systems, for example. And I'm sure we could learn a lot from what some of these island nations and territories.
I'd be very curious to learn some more about the entertainment industry, how it can provide economic development opportunities for islands that maybe haven't embraced that. Again, we're looking for ways that we can diversify the economy and provide different opportunities. And I think there is something there that I need to learn
Yeah.
about from you all on the entertainment side.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And
Yeah.
maybe
There's
someone
always,
listening, right, has
totally.
some ideas. Yeah.
Well, one of my favorite things is connecting people and ideas and things. So maybe there is, someone listening who can get in touch and maybe you'll have a session on this in your next conference. That would be awesome.
Yeah.
That'd be awesome. Well,
Love
very
it.
cool,
Thank you,
James. Thank you
James.
so much for sharing. What you do and what Island Innovation is doing.
Likewise, it was a real pleasure talking, and yeah, I hope there was something interesting there to take away.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
Our designer is Aaliyah Kane. Music is by Peter Chapman. Social media is by Picnic Social. Our producer is Colin Miller.